From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
I'm Sharon Gamble. This week on The Art of the Matter, Buck Creek Players stages a play that explores trust. We learn what's next for our city's art galleries after the demise of IDOTA, and we define automatic art. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All of that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Today, a chance to learn about first-class historic landscapes in our city. But first, what if you were accused of a crime and everyone you knew was adamant that you should plead insanity, but you knew you were perfectly sane? In Tom Topor's 1979 play Nuts, that's the circumstance lead character Claudia finds herself in. Can she trust the public defender assigned to defend her? In Buck Creek Player's upcoming production of Nuts, Jenny White plays Claudia and Michael Swinford plays attorney Aaron Levinsky. I invited them to talk about creating their characters and chemistry on stage. Talk to me a little bit about the relationship between your two characters.
That's a really great setup, isn't it?
I think so. There's a lot.
There's a lot.
It's complicated.
My goodness. Well, I play the role of Claudia Faith Draper. And she has been assigned this attorney named Aaron Levinsky. And she trusts him to the point that she's willing to share some of her history, but not quite all. And so he gets the job of discovering what that looks like on stage and learning some things through this family drama. That I think are surprising both to him and will be, I hope, to the audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Aaron is, he's pretty awesome. He's a public defender from New York, Jewish, totally something opposite than I've ever played. And he gets assigned Claudia. And, you know, he's a public defender in New York City, so he's seen it and done it. And there's something...
He's pretty worldly.
Yeah, yeah. And there's something about Claudia and her case, though, that sparks his interest. And he goes to bat for her big time.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Yeah, and the relationship between the two is not very explored on stage other than courtroom stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But you get to see glimpses of the respect that they end up having for each other. Yeah.
So there's a lot of subtext there for you as actors to get out to the audience masked in the words of the legal proceedings.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of, like, subtext is a great word because there are a lot of things that you can and can't say in a courtroom. And of course that's explored a little bit more in a drama, or a presentation of a courtroom drama. But it's exciting to, work with Michael and have that opportunity to share those moments and explore them. We've only had, I think, 4 rehearsals now, maybe 5, and kind of digging into that a little bit every night and seeing what is new and mm-hmm. exciting and what we can share together as actors and then as characters and bring that to life.
Have you worked together before?
Once.
Just once.
But a dissimilar relationship.
Correct.
Yeah.
It was through the Indie Fringe Festival a few years ago with an original piece. And
I don't think we even had any conversations on stage.
I don't think so.
You're fixing that now.
Yeah.
Jenny, I'm guessing you had to do some research because you probably don't have any real life experience with the crime that your character is accused of.
That is absolutely true, Sharon. Thank you for setting it up that way.
And if you do, you probably aren't going to admit to it now.
Well, no. I plead the fifth. I am still researching, actually, but Claudia has been charged with first-degree manslaughter. And The whole premise of the show is that her family and the prosecution wants her to be found insane and unable to stand trial.
Mm-hmm.
And she is adamant that she is completely sane,
right,
and not nuts, if you will,
right,
and wanting for her voice to be heard so that she can tell her story. And all of these people are trying to silence her, all of them. And the only one who is really willing to listen is Aaron.
Yeah, and that's goes back to the question that you asked earlier. I mean, we're given the script, and it starts where it starts. We have to, any actor has to fill in the blanks and where, what did they have for breakfast that day? Where did they come from just now? What are they feeling? And, Aaron probably has seen, 100 cases, and he's getting paid to win. He's not getting paid to care.
Right.
And there's something about her that he discovers that, wait a minute, there's more to this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been fun for me to be able to talk to some people that actually do the job that Aaron does and find out some interesting insight to that. I mean, it's been a joy, and the few public defenders that I've spoken to have been very open about it, and it's the love of the game. And then all of a sudden, Claudia becomes more than a game.
Yeah.
It's more than just winning.
So it's people who have become kind of rote in their jobs.
Right.
Right. They know how to be a public defender, and it's
right,
just mind-numbing, the case after case after
right,
case, and the workload is heavy.
Well, and the cool thing is that what I've been told across the board, my question has always been, well, how do you do that? Because if you're a public defender, sometimes you're going to have to defend a bad guy.
Yeah.
I said, how do you do that? And they said, you don't think about that. You do this for the people that are innocent. You do it for the good ones.
Oh.
And Claudia is certainly one of the good ones who Aaron discovers she's not, quote, quote, nuts. And all these people are trying to make her so. And that's my favorite part of the character. It's like he has that quality. He's mm-hmm. going to say, you know what, this isn't right, and we're going to do this. And that's exciting to me.
The play was written in 1979, so kind of late in what we generally think of as the civil rights era,
mm-hmm.
and yet that's something that we still haven't quite figured out where that line is between mental incapacity and guilt. I'm not sure how to say what I'm trying to say here, except that one of the questions a director usually asks at a first table read or an early rehearsal is, whose journey is this play?
Mm.
But from what I've heard from each of you so far, it sounds as though it's both of your journeys.
I think so.
Yeah.
I also think that from the perspective of every single character on stage, it's their own. And so Claudia has a journey that I get to go on with her, and Aaron has a journey that Michael gets to go on with him,
yeah,
and each of the other characters has their own journey as well. The story is really about Claudia wanting to stand trial for herself and plead not guilty under self-defense, and no one will listen. But there's the story of her mother and the story of her father and
right,
their relationship, and the story of, as I said, Aaron and the prosecutor. And so each of those characters obviously plays into that. But I really do think that it is, in addition to that kind of family drama, the other storyline is really about trust and who's in your corner and
right,
who do you want in your corner.
Right, and I think that the word trust is a big deal in this play.
Jenny White plays Claudia, and Michael Swinford plays Aaron and Tom Topor's Nuts at Buck Creek Players. Tim Spradlin directs the production, which runs from September 29th through October 8th at Buck Creek's new facility, 11150 Southeastern Avenue. Get directions, the full cast list, and learn more at buckcreekplayers.com. Keith Hampton wants to know what happens when he turns off his conscious mind and allows art to flow from him. Automatica is his exhibit of paintings and sculpture resulting from experiments with so-called automatic drawing, and I was curious about how that works, so I invited Keith and Gallery 924 director Shannon Linker to talk about the show. Keith, I want you to start by describing, you've brought two pieces from the show, one painting and one 3D piece. I want you to describe them to me.
Okay. Well, the painting is a small 12 by 12 gallery wrap canvas. It's acrylic, and it is a work that features multi-layers of kind of curvilinear shapes and lines. They're sort of biomorphic, if you want to use that kind of term, and there are layers that start at the very back, which are somewhat expressionistic, and as you work your way towards the front, they become more and more controlled, and the colors get a little bit brighter and more present.
And then, I don't know if it's literally a companion piece, but the 3D sculpture. Let's talk about that.
The 3D sculpture is a ceramic piece. It's about, 14 inches tall, and it is made up of shapes that are similar to the shapes in the painting, but they're intersecting each other and cutting through each other in a way that presents a little bit better in three dimensions. You can see from all the different angles how they kind of, the shapes are married to each other and where they intersect and kind of what happens in that. And they're pierced with circles, shapes, and piercings so that you can see through them and see the other shapes behind them.
I love your term biomorphic because when I first looked at images online of your paintings and then at the real thing, I think of something from a biology lab. It's very organic, it looks alive. And I want to know how you came to the idea of, I want you first to define what automatic drawing is and then how you came to that technique.
Okay, well, first to describe automatic drawing, it is letting your body reach a state of almost subconsciousness first. So typically the person that's engaged in this behavior will wait until they're almost asleep or they've just woken up. So it's as close as you can get to the subconscious but still being awake enough to grab a pencil or a pen. And then you close your eyes and put your hand on the paper with the pen in it and let your body just make gestural movements randomly. You try not to control them or think about them too much. And that is the basis of all of the work at this show, is those automatic drawings that I did over a period of 3 months.
Do you have any problem? Lots of times, artists of all kinds, not just visual artists, but they do the first draft of work, and then their inner editor kicks in, and they go back, and they tinker with it. Did you have to unlearn that step?
Oh, no. That's a huge part of the process, is actually taking the drawings, which can, to the untrained eye, look like scribbles in some cases. But I actually take those and bring them on into the digital world, do a lot of heavy editing and heavy manipulation of those lines, and then create works from those that I then print out and then use that printout as the basis of the paintings or the sculptures.
Okay. Shannon, what was your first thought when you guys started talking about putting this show together?
Well, my first thought would be that the work would be very raw and organic and have these amorphic shapes and things like that, and maybe some hidden underlying symbols that would come through. And because I'm thinking about the history of automatic drawing in the early 20th century and what came of that. And then I was really surprised, one, that Keith, because I know his work and I know him and I know how detailed he can be and how almost obsessed with having things perfect and complete and all of that. So I was really shocked that he would have completed work that is so free and organic like that. And so when he explained to me that, well, no, those aren't the final drawings, I use the automatic drawing as a platform, as a base to get started. And then I go in and really fine-tune everything. And I said, okay, that makes sense with what I know about you and your work. And when I, and now that I see it, it makes total sense now. And I get the connection to the history of automatic drawing, and I get the connection to his work. And it's very cool.
How do you know, and we're having this conversation a few weeks before your show opens, but how did you know, or how will you know, when the pieces for this exhibition are complete? Is it just a matter of turning the calendar over and saying, I'm out of time? Or do you have some internal signal that says, this is the end of this collection?
Well, I actually, it's for me, it's more of a logistics problem of the gallery 924 and what they can hold and what can realistically be shown without getting too salon style and crowded, because I'm constantly creating works, so that doesn't stop. There just comes a point in time where I say, okay, I have to draw a line, and these works are going to go in the show, and mm-hmm. anything from here on can't.
Artist Keith Hampton and Gallery 924 director Shannon Linker. Keith has been working on the pieces in this show for nearly 2 years. The exhibit is called Automatica, and it opens October 6th at the Art Council's Gallery 924 at 924 North Pennsylvania Street. Learn more about the exhibit at indiearts.org and check out Keith's work at itsallart.com. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Just around the corner, how did Indy's First Friday gallery scene become the success it is today? But first, Eat Drink Indy's Jolene Ketzenberger talks about Earth to Table, a collaborative dinner planned by ceramicist Tim Compton of the Indianapolis Art Center and chef Alan Sternberg of Cerulean. The dinner is this Sunday at Cerulean.
We are talking collaboration today, and it's a collaboration between chef Alan Sternberg and ceramic artist Tim Compton. So thank you both for being here. Well, Alan, tell me just a little bit about yourself and what you do at Cerulean and with the Common House, the pop-up series.
So I'm the chef at Cerulean, Indianapolis. I have been there 3.5 years or so. We try to work with a lot of local producers, a lot of local farmers and whatnot to really be true to what Indiana gives us and make the best food possible. At Common House, it's a pop-up with my wife, Audra. We, one Sunday a month, give or take, we try to, you know, create an event for a day, a small group of people, 20 to 24 people, and really try to push ourselves. We always have a theme to the thing, and we just want to do things that are fun, and we might not be able to do day-to-day at the restaurant, but you know, we really want to continue to grow and motivate ourselves to keep pushing forward.
Now, Tim, tell me what you do. You're with the Indianapolis Arts Center.
Yeah, so what I primarily focus on day-to-day is actually the programming that we offer to primarily adults is my focus. So looking at all the different art media that we offer, glassblowing, ceramics, all those different studios, and making sure that we're offering a great spectrum of classes. And that also helps to inform my art outside of the Art Center, where I primarily focus on ceramics. But again, trying to get into, like Alan said, trying to be creative, trying to get outside of the norm and explore new ideas.
So this upcoming dinner is an interesting collaboration. There'll be a multi-course dinner that Alan and Tim, you have both been involved in. So let's talk a little bit about how you have each been working on creating this dinner. Tim, let's start with you, because this all started with place settings. So talk a little bit about how you approach the design of a plate or a serving piece and kind of how this all started.
Yeah, so I make sort of decorative functional work, and I've always just made pots, more or less, from a artist standpoint. So I'm looking at it and based on the aesthetics of the piece and what I want the piece to look like. And while I've always made dinner settings and functional work, I've never had everyone kind of sit down around the piece and really focus on using it. There are all of our dishes at home we use on a daily basis, but that's not in the same formal sense that a restaurant utilizes a dish and the way that a chef really thinks about that piece as a canvas for the presentation of the food. So I was really excited to take on this challenge, more or less, of working with a chef to design dishes that are actually relevant to the food that's being served on them. So just kind of taking it out of the pure aesthetic and putting that functional aspect, which dishes are made for, into consideration as part of the making process.
Well, now, Alan, talk about your first reactions to the idea of working with a ceramic artist to create, you know, who would create the serving pieces for a meal that you would create. I mean, you were very excited right off the bat.
Yeah, of course, because it's continuing the story. You know, we are somewhat limited in what we can do. You know, I can only buy the plates that I have, or I can only buy the plates that are available to me. So the idea of like starting this process right from the very beginning and really kind of dragging it through to, you know, how that affects the way we conceptualize a dish and then ultimately serve the dish was a really exciting proposition for me. And I realized it was probably about a week and a half ago when you dropped off most of the samples that I realized I had never had a input on a whole place setting before, like a whole several course collection. And it really was a collection, and it was quite clear that it was. And that, to me, was really exciting to really sit down and start thinking about that in the sense of a meal, because so much of what I do is typically just about the food. And to be able to start thinking about, all right, we want this. I think there's two or three pieces that are a little less functional for, you know, day-to-day use, but they're very specific for this dinner that are really exciting to me to be able to put food in, to be able to look at, to be able to hand to a guest. So
you can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indie Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2 The Point. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and coming up, exploring cool cities with kids. But first, after nearly 15 years, the Indianapolis Downtown Artists and Dealers Association, or IDADA, is dissolving. A Lilly Endowment grant helped create the organization, which gave independent artists and businesses a seat at the table when the city was looking to add more outdoor and indoor art to the scene. And WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer recently talked with IDADA President Joy Hernandez-Butler. Jill, tell us more.
You know, Sharon, the downtown cultural district, specifically Mass Ave, Fountain Square, and the Canal District, they would not be the thriving venues that they are today if it really hadn't been for the work of this eclectic group of entrepreneurs, is really the best way to describe them. So before Joy and I talked about the present and future of IDADA, she recapped a bit of IDADA's past.
So in the first place, we had First Fridays. We were the founders of First Friday in Indianapolis. There are First Fridays around the country, and there's First Thursdays in Muncie, and other communities have Second Saturday or whatever. But in Indianapolis, First Fridays started out as the IDADA First Friday Art Tour. And that was an initiative undertaken in 2004, 2005, and it has since grown, which is awesome. Hey, great. Good job, guys. Restaurants, you know, other businesses, music venues, all have their own take on First Friday now, which is also great. It's just the natural, you know, way of things growing. But and then after that, you know, once First Fridays kind of got established, then we had the Super Bowl and we had Turf, and that was a big mission for IDADA to undertake, a big plan, an event, and we did that. We pulled that off. What was next? We looked around. But there wasn't much next. So we could use our time to come up with whatever's next, or we could use our time to get out of the way for whoever has those fresh ideas. Because implementing those fresh ideas would still come back to that same dozen people tops. And they were tired.
A lot of people maybe forget the fact that when IDADA started, there was no Facebook, there was no social media, there was none of that immediate outreach for independent artists and businesses, which was the mission, the creation mission of IDADA, was to represent those underrepresented.
In the beginning, I mean, IDADA was really founded because there was the, you know, an opportunity from the Lilly Endowment. It was the Indianapolis Cultural Development Commission. And that was a way for, you know, they were trying to build an art scene, you know, the cultural trail, all the stuff that we now have and enjoy in Indianapolis. And obviously it didn't exist 15 years ago. But at the time, there wasn't any way for individual people, individual artists, you know, like myself, let's just use myself as an example, as an artist, I wouldn't have been able to access any part of that money from that. It was $6 million, you know, that you could have sculptures or paintings or whatever that would just beautify the city. As a, you know, personally as an artist, I wouldn't have been able to, you know, get a seat at the table. So IDOTA was founded as a not-for-profit that could be that seat at the table to speak for the artists and then help organize those artists into, you know, those opportunities.
Because many members have been a part of IDOTA since the beginning, because it hasn't 15 years and they're still there. What kind of growth among those artists? Do they feel more confident now and able that to go out on their own and to get some of the city money, and they feel like they're a lot more linked in? I mean, IDOTA really served a purpose.
Yes, it really did. And that's what also feels right about this time. You know, the mission accomplished. We served that purpose, and we've helped to grow the art scene, the art world in Indianapolis. So there are artists here now that are showing nationally, internationally. They have their own projects. They're going all over the place and creating art, and they came from here. They grew up out of here as artists. And there's new waves of new artists coming along, you know, the millennials or whatever, you know, or whatever comes after millennials. All those artists are graduating from Heron and UIndy and other arts programs, you know, right now. And they're going to seize the day and start up their own scene, their own galleries, their own whatever, you know, they'll take on this new world. You know, much like we talked about that, you know, there wasn't a Facebook, there wasn't YouTube or any of those things. I have full confidence this is all going to continue on. Artists, we're all going to support each other. The artists that were part of and the, you know, other members that were part of IDOTA aren't disappearing. We're not all just fleeing Indianapolis. You know, the Arts Council is picking up a lot of the mission that IDOTA had. And we did have a lot of overlap to begin with. Once the Arts Council really got going, you know, the IDOTA predates a lot of that. And so a lot of that mission just overlaps. And they are, by the notion of being an arts council, are in a better position to take on some of those opportunities because they are a paid staff, a larger staff. We were a group of volunteers. We were giving of our time while trying to manage our own arts careers and other careers if you're an artist that also has to do something else, you know. And it's a lot, you know, unless it's your sole job to do that. So the Arts Council will be picking up a lot of that. There's been talk of, let's call them think tanks. If, you know, a group of, say, younger artists came up and said, hey, we want to start something that kind of looks like this and kind of like that, they could come and talk to the Arts Council, and the Arts Council will say, hey, well, Joy knows how to do that, or Mark Rushman's over here, and he's a wonderful curator of shows and has a history in this, or, you know, Maureen Malone Reed did the maps for IDOTA, and you guys want to organize some sort of trail wayfinding thing? Well, she already knew how to do all of that and is a great, you know, advertiser, graphic designer. Let's, you know, hey, go talk to this person. You know, we will still be there as people, as resources for whatever comes next.
Of course, IDOTA has also spawned new areas of art in the city, which is exciting. Garfield Park is taking on its own kind of personality down there with the Tube Factory and a couple of other galleries. The Stutz is actually making a comeback once again, Sharon, mm-hmm. which is exciting to see.
And Carmel has their second Saturdays,
which is highly attended mm-hmm. and a great way to see a lot of different artists, a lot of crossover artists from both Marion County and Hamilton County. And then, of course, the Circle Center Industrial Complex is just booming with businesses, artists, kind of the whole point of IDOTA is really kind of captured right there in CCIC. So we can only hope for more great local art in the future. And as Joy pointed out, they'll be around to help continue to contribute the artists themselves.
Fantastic. An ever-changing art scene. And we have some other snapshots from our ever-changing art scene on that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
So you can get a bird's eye view of comfortable living at different kinds of homes on this unusual home tour. It's a tour of chicken coops. It's called the Tour de Coop. It's this Sunday from 1 to 5. You're going to start at Agrarian at 1051 East 54th Street. And I've been on this before. I have to tell you, even if you're not thinking about keeping urban chickens, it's a lot of fun. A lot of interesting people keeping chickens, and you can check them out and their often fanciful chicken coops.
running through September 30th, once again at the Long Sharp Gallery. It's Dale Enoch's On the Rocks. I had a chance to see this exhibit. We did a Facebook Live from there. Amazing work that's usually found outdoors is brought indoors to the Long Sharp Gallery. It's located in the Conrad Hotel. So if you're in the Conrad and there's somebody around, they'll probably let you in the gallery to take a look.
And if you need some more ideas, you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide, or join us again next week for our calendar we call What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Coming up, what's a cultural landscape? But right now, a new book aimed at mid-grade school-age children helps families find the fun. It's by Indianapolis native and Broad Ripple High School grad Gabriella Balkan, and it's called 50 Cities of the USA, and our own Art of the Matter kids, Veronica and Max, checked it out with their mom, Jill Sheridan, for our With Kids segment.
Look, what is this
hello,
number?
Hello, 50. Hello,
that's right.
Hello,
we pull out our new copy of 50 Cities by Gabriel Balkin.
This is 50 Cities of the United States.
The bright yellow coffee table book features a large picture of the United States with colorful icons of sights from sea to sea.
There's Indianapolis.
Max and Veronica's interests have been piqued.
Things that you can do in 50 different cities.
We turn to the page that features Indianapolis.
42.
Balkin, the author, actually grew up in Indy. In an email, she says it's a great place to be a kid with an incredible mix of culture, athletics, and nature. Every city that's highlighted in the book includes a fun map and an hour-by-hour list of things to do for a day in Indianapolis. First stop, Holiday Park.
What do they look like?
The remains, or ruins, of a turn-of-the-century New York building came to Indianapolis in the 50s.
They're being crushed.
Looks like maybe they're holding up the building.
The statue, Races of Man, features three massive figures, African-American, Asian, and Caucasian, holding up the building together.
No, it's crying.
The newly rehabbed ruins features two fountains and other surprising sculptures and comfy benches to take in the sights.
Little bronze animals.
Snake, frog, turtle, frog.
It's a beautiful early September day, and our next stop is the Indianapolis Arts Center in Broad Ripple.
All right, it says 2 p.m., which we're actually pretty close. Visit the Arts Park, the 12-acre garden at the Indianapolis Arts Center. You can take a selfie in front of John McNaughton's Twisted House, a lopsided cedar house whose roof hits the ground. See it?
Yeah, I wish I could go in.
All right, let's take a picture. Everybody get in. Say Twisted House.
Twisted House!
The grounds of the center feature an arts park packed with sculptures and interactive exhibits. A large bright blue piece looks to resemble a raindrop or whale. The wire mesh figure is covered with reflective blue squares and written messages.
It's fun to be a loser.
No, not.
Try a little harder to be a little better.
One outside painting pays tribute to one of Indiana's most famous characters.
Who's that?
Freddy Fazbear.
Who? Garfield.
I know
who
like
also
Garfield.
Gets a mention in the 50 Cities book.
What is he like?
Sort of Libra.
No.
What did he like?
Lasagna.
Oh.
Did not like
the day in Indy list also suggests kissing the bricks at the IMS, but we opt for a more time-efficient choice.
That's from Mommy Daddy. All right. On the count of three, blow a kiss to the bricks. One. Two, three.
Three.
Mwah. Good job.
I never realized how many quality art parks Indy has. We hit 3 on the list, including 100 acres at the Indianapolis Museum of Art.
Here, come here.
The park opened in 2010 and features large-scale installations in a natural setting. Artists from all over the world contributed pieces, including one that really captures children's imagination.
What is that?
I don't know.
I think that's his kneecap. What's this?
His skull!
His skull.
Funky Bones.
Funky Bones, 2010, Plywood and Fiberglass by Altlier van Lieshout.
What?
Dutch.
A hike through the woods along the lake leads to the visitor center. The windowed building is a piece of art in itself and gives us a chance to chill out.
Just want to hear the guy that... This is the guy that made this place.
I'm Max Anderson, the Melvin and Brand Simon director and CEO.
His name's Max.
We
really only make it to a fraction of the places listed in the 50 Cities book. But we couldn't pass up one mention.
This is the name of the place. Mug and Bun.
We pull up to a true indie institution.
See, he's got a tray on the side. See?
The kids' first drive-in restaurant.
You turn up. Hi.
Classic Indiana fare.
What do you think about eating in the drive-in?
Better than I thought.
Better than you thought.
Jill, Veronica, and Max Sheridan reviewed indie native Gabrielle Balkan's kids' book, 50 Cities of the USA. In 1998, Charles Birnbaum, a landscape architect with an appreciation for history, founded the Cultural Landscape Foundation. It's a not-for-profit organization, and it's responsible for a number of initiatives that help us discover the many splendid natural designs in our communities. October 6th through the 8th, you can participate in the first-ever What's Out There Weekend Indianapolis, which comprises free tours of dozens of parks, gardens, cemeteries, neighborhoods, and much more. I called Charles Birnbaum to find out how the What's Out There idea got started and to learn more about what a cultural landscape is and how it's protected and perpetuated. Let's start with a definition of the term cultural landscape. What is a cultural landscape?
So a cultural landscape is really, as soon as you step outside your house, you're in a cultural landscape. It is any landscape that's been affected or influenced or shaped by human participation or involvement. So it can be something like a design landscape, as many of the parks and boulevards are in Indianapolis. It can be a historic site, such as a state capitol or a presidential home. It could be a vernacular landscape like New Harmony, Indiana, or it could be a landscape associated with what we call ethnographic values, for example, Native peoples. And so all of those collectively are a cultural landscape.
How old is the field of cultural landscapes?
Well, I think the idea of cultural landscapes goes back to the geography field in the 1920s and 30s. It really wasn't until the late 1970s and early 1980s that the National Park Service started to use this terminology of cultural landscapes in the four types that I just mentioned. Our work at the Cultural Landscape Foundation, although we focus on all of these types of landscapes, we tend to pay special attention to landscapes that are part of our urban environments, again, that we move through every day, that they're not acts of God, that, you know, someone designed Garfield Park. We didn't just put a fence around it. And so I think that in our work at the foundation, we now have over, for example, 2,000 types of landscapes in our What's Out There database.
And you started that project. What inspired you to do that?
Well, I spent 15 years, well, let me back up by saying I'm trained as a landscape architect.
Okay.
So when I was in the private sector, I had the good fortune of working on great parks designed by people like Frederick Law Olmsted and George Kessler and others. But in the early 1990s, I went to the National Park Service to set policy. So in a way that there are standards, and if you rehabilitate historic buildings in the U.S. that go back to the 1960s, we never had standards like that for landscapes. And I spent 5 years authoring that document, which are part of the National Park Service's guidelines. It's called Guidelines for the Treatment of Cultural Landscapes. So, for example, if you live in Indianapolis and you are moving down a parkway that is part of the Kessler Park and Boulevard system, which is over 2,100 acres,
right,
technically, if you have state funds, you're supposed to use those guidelines. And part of the reason I created the Cultural Landscape Foundation is I thought, well, this whole top-down approach, this approach of sticks and not carrots, for example, is crazy. Landscape is so personal. You know, gardening and golf are America's favorite pastime. And so what I wanted to do is to really teach people how to see and how to value landscapes that are around them. And so in 1998, I had the good fortune of founding the Cultural Landscape Foundation while I was a Loeb Fellow at the Harvard Graduate School of Design. And the goal of the foundation is really to connect people to places, to teach them how to see and how to value often the invisible hand of the landscape architect. And Indianapolis is just one of those cities that is blessed with an incredible legacy that we're looking forward to making visible through our What's Out There weekend tours, and then through our online What's Out There database, which is completely GPS enabled. So you can literally pull out a smartphone, hit a button that says what's nearby, and every public landscape within 25 miles will be splayed out before you.
Wow. I have so many questions, but I want to circle back for a moment and have you put on your hat both as a trained landscape architect and as someone who has helped develop guidelines for rehabilitating, renovating cultural landscapes. Unlike a bricks and mortar building, which is relatively stable, earthquakes and tsunamis notwithstanding, a landscape matures, and I'm curious about at what, if you're rehabilitating something, how do you decide what year to go back to? How it looked when it was first planted, how it looked when it was 10 years old, when it was mature at 25 years old. How do you decide that?
Well, there's a couple of answers to that question. First, let me give you a kind of a cheeky answer. You know, a cultural landscape can be like Cate Blanchett. We're dealing with great bone structure.
Okay.
And the reality is, whether you're talking about a park designed by George Kessler like Garfield Park or Holiday Park, which has multiple layers of interesting history, that when you do the research, the landscape will tell you its story. It's no different than dealing with ecological and natural systems. I think a lot of landscape architects, when they graduate with a master's degree or an undergraduate degree in landscape architecture, they think of their toolkit as preparing them to deal with nature and ecology. And so landscapes have different carrying capacity, and that's where I think there is sort of this line between when you get to restore the bone structure, the visual and spatial relationships, versus when you actually do something very precise like you might at the Miller Garden or in a more detailed landscape at the Indianapolis Museum of Art, for example, the formal gardens that were designed by Percival Gallagher and the Olmsted brothers.
And there might be some pragmatic considerations as well. There may be plants that are no longer available or plants that are no longer desirable because of pests or
invasives. I mean, you know, when you look back to the work of the Olmsteds, for example, and there are certain plants that plague Olmsted landscapes even today, like Japanese knotweave or honeysuckle, that the Olmsteds planted because they were so quick to take over and stabilize slopes. The other thing during the early days of a lot of these landscapes, this is, would have been in Kessler's day as well in Indianapolis, is, you know, often they had the budget to plant things, to overplant. And so I think that there's water concerns today, there's invasives. I think we know a lot more about types of plants to increase wildlife habitat. So I think, it depends on the landscape. You know, it's interesting when we talk about the kind of nature-culture challenge or opportunity. You know, think about, for example, one of our tour sites, the Nina Mason Pulliam Ecolab, you know, which is part of a landscape that was originally created by the great landscape architect Jens Jensen. And so all of these things, what they have in common, to go back to the bone structure, it's about managing change, that you can manage change in a way that I think of what I call a symphonic language, where we can actually look at Massachusetts Avenue and understand the great turn-of-the-century commercial building architectures there, and yet still create a landscape that is new, that's part of the fabric that goes back to Ralston's plan of 1821. So it's a common language, and it's a story that we keep telling. It's a tapestry that we add to. And a city is like a text. It's a manuscript that we're editing. And some people are better editors than others. And so what we hope to do with this weekend is to put a spotlight on some spaces that people think they know well and show them a little bit more. We also want to actually reveal spaces that I think are some jewels that are below the radar.
Charles Birnbaum founded the Cultural Landscape Foundation. Their signature What's Out There weekend is coming to Indianapolis October 6th through the 8th. You can take free, expertly guided tours of stunning places like the Ball Nurses Sunken Garden, Butler University's Holcomb Gardens, Raymond Lepard's Estate, the Woodruff Place Historic District, and many, many more. Get the details at tclf.org and click on the Events tab. And if you like gardens and landscapes, check out the What's Out There website. It'll help you discover natural gems when you travel. Again, that's TCLF. That's short for the Cultural Landscape Foundation. So tclf.org. Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm here with Carl Selm, the bass player for Sweet Poison Victim. Sweet Poison Victim will be playing with the legendary Jamaican band, the Scatolites, on Friday, September 15th at Pioneer in Fountain Square. Carl, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. This is exciting.
And Carl, Sweet Poison Victim recently issued a new EP. It's got a very creative title, Second Tape.
That's right. That's correct.
And I thought this EP was a great representation of the band's sound. And give us a description of what that sound is.
For the second release, we really kind of, it represents a further coalescence of what the heck we're trying to do with our music. That is to say, we're getting better at making high life. It comes naturally to us now. Kwesi can give us ideas, and then we can just turn it into reality a heck of a lot quicker than when we were first starting out. And you can hear that, the easiness in the music this time around on this new EP.
And High Life is a form of popular music from Ghana.
Yes.
In West Africa. And the leader of the group, so to speak, is Kwesi Brown, who was born and raised in Ghana and came to the United States.
Right, right, yeah.
Study music.
He taught us everything we knew, basically. Before that, I was in a hardcore band, but I stuck with this high life style because I love it, and it's really exciting to understand, you know?
And the tape is also available digitally on Bandcamp at sweetpoisonvictim.bandcamp.com, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And Carl, you have five songs to share with us today.
Uh-huh.
Five songs that have influenced you in some way, right?
Yes.
What is your first song for us?
Well, I wanted to start with a couple of my favorite high life tracks. Just so people could have a little bit of context. A.B. Krenzel is a favorite of mine, and he does this version of the Lord's Prayer, and for whatever reason, I have never been so excited to hear a prayer. You gotta hear it.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth. In heaven, give us this day our daily bread. Oh,
and number two.
Number two is Kanado's superstar dance band. They had a medley called Inowa, and it's a kind of northern high life style that the melody is basically dictated by the words. It's a tonal language. So the lyrics dictate the tune, and I just, it's really fascinating to me. Now, I haven't been able to figure out how to speak the language, not even close, but the idea that the meaning can determine the tune is just really fascinating to me. Number three is Turtles Have Short Legs by Can. This song was sampled in the PlayStation game Parappa the Rappa, and I was obsessed with that even though I had Nintendo 64 back then. And like decades later, I heard the original version, which is Turtles Have Short Legs, and like, you can't not smile when you hear this song. I love Can, and this is just what a bunch of geniuses do when they're goofing around, basically. Number four is Na Cherni Den by Yanka Diaghileva. She's like, she was an anarchist from Soviet Union. She died mere months before the Soviet Union collapsed. They found her body in a river, but her lungs were not full of water. The official story is she drowned, but wouldn't there be water in her lungs? Everything she says is deep as heck. She's from the Chicago of Russia called Novosibirsk. Third biggest city in Russia, nobody knows.
And number five.
Number five has got to be... let's go with Teja by Caetano Veloso.
Thank you, Carl. These are great songs. And what's the best way to keep up with Sweet Poison Victim online?
You can follow us on Facebook. If you just look us up on Facebook, you're definitely going to get the most updates on when our shows and releases are coming out.
And a special hello to your dad, who I know loves to tune in to Art of the Matter every week.
Yeah, hi, Dad. Hi, Mom.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 8 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Jill Dittmeyer and Jill Sheridan. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 8. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, an in-depth conversation with the director of the new film Columbus. We'll meet the Fat Turtle Theater Company and get a peek at Wes Rutenberg's small studio session. And, of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All of that and much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.